This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hi, and welcome to the August 4th edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm Mike Hogan here with in-studio Eric Wing, and via remote, via Skype, or whatever this technology is, at Saratoga, we have Mr. Peter Thomas Fornatel. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
How are you guys doing?
Great. Great. How about you, Peter?
It's my birthday today, actually.
Several years ago,
I decided that I would spend every birthday I could for the rest of my life in Saratoga. Since I made that decision, it hasn't worked out all that well at the betting windows. I do remember there was one day in the late 90s where on my birthday, a horse named Birthday ran. Of course, it was the 1990s. I was a new player. Hunch plays were still a part of my arsenal. I bet the thing, it won. I thought, here we go. The next 17 years or so, we're going to have this great success on my birthday betting. Didn't work out that way. So at least this year, I found a way not to lose money on my birthday simply because they're dark.
Peter is sort of like the anti-Bill Mott.
Evidently, the anti-Bill Mott, and you said Schossberg too, right? Anti-Bill, or is Schossberg's daughter?
Don Schossberg. Daughter or wife? I wasn't sure which, but Don Schossberg shares a birthday with Bill Mott, actually, and the Schossberg barn has had a lot of success over the years that day too. It just doesn't get the ink of Bill Mott.
Well, you share a birthday as well. Did you realize this?
Barack Obama, Roger Clemens, Maurice the Rocket Richard. August 4th is a big day.
No, I'm talking specifically about DRF's own Todd Unger. You and Todd Unger share the same birthday.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So
and sometime podcast co-host.
Uh-oh. We're losing Pete. Mike, I think we'll want. Oh, there we go. Pete, back.
It's a big birthday week here at DRF.
Yes, it is. It absolutely is. You were saying sometimes pod co-host, and then you cut out for a second there.
Oh, I believe Matt Bernier's birthday was this week too.
Ah, well, he'll be back after the summer. He has committed to being a little bit more active on the pod, but the Del Mar and Saratoga duties pull him away. So fortunately, we get folks like Eric to sit in, and today we're going to be talking a lot about racing, obviously, and specifically the top races this weekend, of which there were quite a few, and the conversation, I would imagine, will be dominated by one American Pharoah in the William Hill Haskell Invitational. All I got to say is wow.
Yeah, I mean, and the wow part of it wasn't the final margin. To me, it was how he toyed right. with competitive edge and upstart, almost like they were paid workout partners, right. you know. It came off just like a workout where, you'll stalk him and then just go by when you're ready and we'll bring a fresh challenger late. I wasn't at Monmouth. I happened to watch the race from Parks, and the crowd there was going nuts, saying, just how he toyed with him. And I think everybody watching at home felt much the same way. It was the great thing about Pharoah is when you think you've seen his best, he gives you a performance like he did on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And now we look, if you win the Triple Crown, as far as I'm concerned, you're a great horse. But this is just adding to his, not so much to his resume, though it is, but to his story, his legend. Mm-hmm. And this Haskell will certainly go down in history, I think, as one of the greatest Haskell performances ever. No offense to those who have come before him. And it just leaves you all the more excited for what might come next.
Absolutely. And you mentioned it. I think the final margin of victory was listed at 2 lengths, but it probably could have been 10 times that if they wanted it to be. I don't know if I've seen a horse more geared down late and never in jeopardy of losing that race.
And it's funny, I think Travis Stone or somebody said something similar on Twitter, and I completely agree. To me, the whole notion in general of, oh, he could have won by much more if they had wanted to, is usually a bunch of bull. A horse under a hand ride is typically going almost as fast as he is under, you know, full whip urging.
Right.
And, you know, people thinking that a horse could win by five additional lengths if put to his task, it is just wrong-headed thinking in general.
Rarely this, the case. Right.
This was one case where it did, you know, especially late, he wasn't being asked. And Keen Ice was under a full drive and cutting into the margin, but, you know, it looked like they were saving something for the next time.
Right. I agree. Pete, you have been quiet. I'm sure you have a lot to say. What is your takeaway from the performance that you saw on Sunday?
To your guy's point, I've never seen one win like that with what I would describe as a double handful for a good portion of the race. We're not talking about a horse that was just geared down late. I feel like we're talking about a horse who was never really asked to run to his maximum ability. It was incredible. I toyed with the field is a great way to describe it. And the final margin of victory does not at all get into what a dominating performance this was. I haven't seen yet. What speed figure did it come back with?
Well, so before I say, do you want to take any sort of guess? This knowing that he was so geared down late and knowing that his previous top was a 105, what do you think he might have gotten?
I would have guessed probably about a 105.
109 was the final figure. And I didn't check to see
what
that...
And he probably could have run a second or two faster than that.
Oh, for sure, for sure. I did not check to see what that meant. I think it meant that Keen Ice got a 104. I can double check that.
At a mile and an eighth, a 109, if he was two lengths back, that would be about a 106.
Okay.
It would be less than 2 points per length at a mile and an eighth. At a mile, it would be a flat 2 points per length. Mm. At a mile and an eighth, it would be just. So I'm guessing 106. If the margin was 2.5, I can't remember what it was. Then it might be a 105 or 104.
Okay. I know Upstart also got a triple digit buyer. I don't remember. I looked briefly, but I didn't. Mainly, I was just focusing on what Pharaoh got because everybody else was, like you said, Pete. Really running for second. And let's face it, I mean, he sat and stalked Competitive Edge, who is a very good sprinter, probably won't see two turns, I would imagine, again. The same could be said for Mr. Jordan, who I think was coming into the race seen as potentially one that could muddy the pace, and he ran pretty much in the race for 6 furlongs, looked like he was... hit in the chest with a baseball bat after that. Evidently, he came out of the race fine. He's going to get a little time at the farm. But these were horses that were legitimate early pace that were running their race, and he just sat there. He stalked them. He took over when he wanted, and he never looked back.
Yeah, I was thinking now with the wonderful benefit of 2020 hindsight, I thought the pace was pretty hot. Competitive Edge, the battle, the strategy was to just send, and he performed in a manner that you just said. He's a good one-turn horse. He'll probably wind up next in the King's Bishop, which, you know, no less than the likes of Tail of the Cat did that mile and an eighth turn back to win the King's Bishop.
And Hardspun, right?
And Hardspun, yes. Upstart, it looked like early on, he probably had the trip that Rick Violette wanted. Mm-hmm. You know, let's let Competitive Edge and American Pharaoh knock heads, if you're going to call what American Pharaoh did knock heads, and then we'll pick up the pieces. We'll get first run and pounce.
Sure.
Except that, you know, Upstart was off the bench, and American Pharaoh's a lot of horse.
Right.
But the pace was hot. Right. And American Pharaoh was attending that pace under no urging whatsoever. But a hot pace is a hot pace. It's going to take its toll late, and that's why perhaps even though he was under no urging, you didn't see him draw off and win by seven like at the Belmont or 10 or 12. And Keen Ice was closing the gap somewhat at the end. Had that pace been 48 or slower, then I think under the same early scenario, you would have seen American Pharoah just run off the screen, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But and what I just said sort of gives a little extra credit to Upstart and Competitive Edge for being up front. And Mr. Jordan, though he was absolutely no factor at the end, certainly did contribute to the pace.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think, obviously, this was August 2nd where he ran this race. Had this been, I mean, certainly a different field, but if he was facing a field like this in the Breeders' Cup Classic, or if this was his stated final race, I think we would have seen a show. They wrapped him up. Victor wrapped him up because he knew this wasn't the end goal. He just had to win it. He had to move on. He had to keep his horse. Next we might see him. They're talking possibly the Travers. Certainly the end goal is the Breeders' Cup Classic. But I think it would have been amazing to see, had this been his stated final race, just what kind of show he could have put on.
Yeah, and actually, I'd rather see that show in the Breeders' Cup
Of course, of course.
Than against Upstart and Competitive Edge and Keen Ice. So I'm glad they did what they did.
For sure, absolutely. Pete, anything else to say before we move on to some of the other racing from the weekend?
Yeah, I definitely want to talk a little more about the Pharoah. The thing that struck me about seeing him win like that, I even yelled it from the Saratoga grandstand where I was watching, as if Victor could hear me, and I said, "Save a little something for the Travers," you know, as he's doing this. But Matt often on the show takes the Debbie Downer role. My only Debbie Downer note on this whole thing is, I think as much as Zayat wants to come here, as much as it makes so much sense if you're trying to position this horse as one of the greatest horses to come here, I can't get away from those other Baffert quotes, especially in that Sports Illustrated article. I have to think it's unlikely. I will say this, going into the race, I think I put the chances at about between 5 and 10% that the Pharoah would come to Saratoga. Now I think maybe they've eked up to like 25%, but I mean, people around here in Saratoga, they're talking about it like it's a done deal, and I don't see that.
Yeah. I'm with you, Pete. I was skeptical going in. I mean, I think there's certainly a chance, and it's a better chance than what we were looking at last week, I would imagine. But that 100%. Said, you know, it like you said, Pete, they lay out a plan. You don't want to really call audibles regardless of how well the horse is doing, you know. And it sounds like Saratoga was not really seriously ever on that plan. And despite the fact that he won so easily, despite the fact that it would be the sort of thing that everybody would love to see, I don't know if that's enough for them to want to go and change the plan. And I know that they've added an additional $350,000 to the purse. If American Pharoah runs, it'll be a $1.6 million purse if he does indeed run in the Travers. But I would imagine Del Mar may do the same sort of thing for the Pacific Classic, perhaps. And
that's, you know, in 20 days.
Well.
You know, there's no way he's going to run the Pacific Classic in 20 days, I don't think. If you look at the spacing of the Travers and the Goodwood and the Breeders' Cup Classic, it's a perfect plan. And Mike, you keep talking about that it wasn't in the plan, but to me, they never had a plan. Yeah. You know, like the fact that they didn't lay out what the plan was early had made me sort of fear that the Haskell could be his last race. But, you know, as easily as he won, you've got to figure, I mean, it seems weird to me to win like that and then go back to the bench until the Goodwood. But it seems doubly weird to come back in 20 days, even though it's a home game in SoCal. I don't know. Again, I'm still skeptical he's going to come here, but I think it's like almost irrational fear if they don't come here, as opposed to anything having to do with a plan or anything else. I I mean, I think it's, I don't get me wrong.
We cut, we lost Pete there for a second.
What would be the right move?
Sorry, we lost you there, Pete, right before you said, don't get me wrong.
I can see when I'm not on, so don't worry. I'll adjust my accord. Basically, what I was saying is that I don't think it's going to happen, but I feel like it should happen. Mm-hmm. If you follow my meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's fair. But part of the reason why I'm thinking that the Pacific Classic might be on the schedule is my understanding is he's now back in Southern California, and if they were serious about keeping him and targeting him for Saratoga, I know home is in Southern California, but why not keep him here acclimated to the Northeast? You know, certainly Baffert has had horses run at Saratoga. He's certainly had more than he's had run at Monmouth in the last 5 years, 10 years.
He clearly hates the place, though.
Yeah, well, you know.
I think you're right. If there was a plan to come to Saratoga, he would have come straight here. It was clearly going into the Haskell, no doubt in my mind, Baffert had absolutely no intention of sending him here. Right. I feel like the horse has almost asked to come here with his performance, but I still feel like Baffert's concerns, which I think are somewhat, you know, overblown. He's so worried about putting the horse in a position where he might lose. First of all, having seen him run a whole bunch of times, not sure you really need to worry about that too much. Secondly, even if he were to stub his toe and not win, I don't feel like that diminishes the greatness of a horse like this. I think people get too upset and too married to this idea of being undefeated. I think to really show how great your horse is, you know what you do? You run your horse, and you run in spots that make sense.
But come on, Pete. Whenever anybody talks about Secretariat, all they do is mention the loss to Onion, right? I mean, that completely overshadowed.
So good if not for Onion.
Yeah, right, right. They say, you know, he could have been a good one, you know, but he lost to Onion. So it's a fair point, you know, and I would love, regardless, I hope he either runs in the Travers or I think he runs in the Pacific Classic. He's a horse we've seen run back off of relatively short rest and do fantastic. True. He's a horse that I think, and of course, I've never been within, you know, 50 yards of him, so take what I say with a grain of salt, but from what I see in terms of the races, he's a horse that seems to thrive on somewhat regular racing, somewhat, you know, not the 8-week layoff, not the 6-week layoff that you see with a lot of these horses. I wouldn't worry about the term bounce if he comes back in 20 days. Certainly that performance took very little out of him. I would worry more about the shipping cross country than I would about the race. He would have to ship again cross country to come back to Saratoga. I don't know, we'll see. There were a couple other races this weekend that featured competitors that he's likely to face in his next start. There was the Jim Dandy at Saratoga, which was only a 4-horse field, but it was at least a couple, if not three, that may very well run in the Travers next start. And then on the West Coast, we also had the Clement L. Hirsch, which featured a similarly impressive performance from Beholder, who evidently is targeting the Pacific Classic next out. Eric, what's your thought?
Mike, before we move on to the other races this weekend, I mean, I just feel I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the one race that, regarding American Pharoah, that neither you nor Peter have even given a mention to as his possible next start, and that's the Pennsylvania Derby.
That's true.
First of all, I don't think under any circumstances, whether he was targeting the Travers or not, Baffert would ship to Saratoga. I think he'd rather just take him back home and fly him. And if he weren't taking him back home to California, he'd be more likely to send him to Churchill than to stable him at Saratoga. I don't think he likes training over that surface for whatever reason. Just my own humble opinion, I think American Pharoah's debut against older horses is likely to come in the Breeders' Cup Classic. To me, the question is, does he run in the Travers next? Which, like you guys, I think got more possible after this Sunday. Does he run in the Pennsylvania Derby next, which could be for a lot of money, and Ahmed Zayat likes money? Mm-hmm. Or might he run in both? Which, if he's going to pull a 20-day deal, I think that's more likely to be the 20-day deal we see than some sort of Haskell Pacific Classic double.
That's fair. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see wherever he shows up. I mean, certainly the easier spot, I would imagine, would be something like the Pennsylvania Derby, because who's he likely to face in that field?
It's too hard to tell. I mean, you have to think that Texas Red and Frosted are both coming back in the Travers. Otherwise, mm-hmm. they wouldn't have stuck to the Jim Dandy guns. Right. And those are formidable horses.
They are.
And you know, in Texas Red's case, it's a horse that he hasn't done battle with yet, which
right.
makes it a little more intriguing. Mm-hmm. You know, for however much money the Pennsylvania Derby is, they'll get a field together. But this is a case, too, where you wouldn't expect to see too many go from the Travers to the Pennsylvania
right.
Derby, given the fact that the Pennsylvania Derby this year is September 19th, just 3 weeks after the Travers.
Right. Yeah, and so I wonder if it's going to be a lot of the same field that he's seen before, if he does. Which, look, if they decide to do that, you can't knock him at all. He's beaten these horses. There's less to worry about, Pete, to your point about if they're worried about him actually losing, that's probably the safest route. But we'll see. You know, I mean, and certainly Baffert has had success in, you know, doing Haskell to Pennsylvania Derby. I mean, granted, last year he had a little bit of a detour in between. So we'll see, and maybe that's coloring some of the decision-making that's happening in his mind. Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's move on to some of those other races. The Jim Dandy, as you mentioned, was only a four-horse field with the scratches of some of the horses that were cross-entered. Tecton went to run in the Curlin. And then, of course, we had Upstart and Competitive Edge facing American Pharoah in the Haskell. But with it being a short field, it was a pretty interesting, pretty solid race. And Pete, you were there in person, so let's start with your thoughts. What was your takeaway from the Jim Dandy?
Oh, it was such an exciting stretch duel. You don't expect to be thrilled by a four-horse field, but there was a lot of excitement at Saratoga for that race, especially when those two hooked up in the stretch. And I mean, I got maybe a little bit of the impression that Frosted was using it a little bit as a prep, and maybe wasn't fully tightened. Whereas I do think Texas Red, who I'm happy to admit I was probably wrong about. You know, I had said I didn't love the Dwyer. Other people had said they thought it was just a prep and set him up exactly the way it should for the races to come. Those other people are looking a lot more right than me at this point. I think maybe he was a little more designed to win the Dandy, whereas maybe Frost was looking at it a little bit more as a prep.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. That's an absolutely fair point. But look, they both ran good races. I think they both got what they needed in order, whether it was a prep or whether it was a race that they were targeting in and of itself. I think they both come out of it, if they did come out of it well, I think they both are coming into peak form into the Travers, which is, the kind of thing that I would want to do if I were the connections of either of those horses, especially if there's a chance that I might end up having to face American Pharoah.
Yeah, and I don't know whether it was for whom it was a prep and for whom it was a full-out race. I've been wrong more times than I've been right over the years trying to decode and decipher the Jim Dandy in that fashion. But I was sitting there. As a matter of fact, I watched the Jim Dandy at Mountaineer with Peter Berry, who's the track mm-hmm, announcer mm-hmm. at Mountaineer, because it
sure.
was after the Mountaineer card had ended. We both got a kick out of the fact that despite only the four horses, Larry Kalmus was really into the mm-hmm. call. And that's one of those races that kind of was exciting, even if you or I were calling it. But Larry just gave it a great call, and it was, gosh, like you say, what looked like a downer on paper with all the defections. I don't think could have been much more exciting had everybody shown up.
Yeah, turned into quite a good race. And we'll see. You know, I mean, I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was that Texas Red's first two-turn race since the Breeders'
Cup
Juvenile. Yeah. So I think, Pete, to your point, the Dwyer may have set him up for that. I think he's a horse that we've all felt really only wants to go longer. So we'll see. And it should make for an interesting Travers whether we get fair or not. It was obviously dominated by a lot of the American Pharoah talk, but there were four champions in action this past weekend, one of whom you got to see on the undercard of the West Virginia Derby. Three of the four, of course, put in what would be essentially called paid workouts. I'm talking about Work All Week. He looked very good, and I don't know if he was beating a whole lot, but that's the kind of race that you want to see from a champion getting back on the winning side of the equation.
Yes, I think Work All Week, I believe, was in the Senate, Speaker of the House, legislator, representative, senatorial, Republican, Democratic stakes at...
Sprint stakes,
thank you, at Mountaineer. Or somewhere in there is the actual name of of the race. But I was talking to Roger Brueggemann after the race. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you one funny anecdote.
Okay.
The horse ran great, obviously, and everybody was thrilled. Florent Giroux was obviously pleased, said he felt just like he did last year. And admittedly, the horse has had poor luck in his first two starts. And all the connections were quick to mention that, this is the real deal, what we saw today, not when he, broke through the gate at Gulfstream or got left and then rushed up. Richard Papisse was there, Midwest Thoroughbreds. But I felt I had to ask Brueggemann, doing some reporting for Daily Racing Form on site, why did you come here instead of Saratoga? And he said, I wanted to run at Monmouth, but in the Teddy Drone, as too much hassle getting over there. And, the Saratoga race was 7 furlongs. That's the wrong distance. Wait a minute, the Vanderbilt's 6 furlongs. he had to know the distance of the Vanderbilt. But that was a performance that, I would have taken my chances for, 4 times the money against Rockfall?
Sure.
But it seemed like, for all the connections, they just wanted to get him a confidence builder. Mm-hmm. The next race could be the Phoenix at Keeneland.
Okay.
Or Papisse said there was a 50-50
chance. We know it's not the Forgo.
Right. Well, we can safely eliminate the Forgo. Now, what's that, Pete? A mile and an eighth? A mile? No, just kidding. Papisse said there's a 50-50 chance he runs before the Phoenix, depending on how he comes out of the race or whatnot. But it's like... the next to last race this year for him is going to be the Phoenix, and the last race this year is going to be a defense of his Breeders' Cup Sprint title. But it was exciting to see him perform like that.
That's great, yeah. And you mentioned in the Vanderbilt that was the horse that beat him, Favorite Tale, was the one that Pete, you and I think both thought might be the controlling speed. It turned out he was, and just down the lane maybe wasn't quite good enough, and two horses in the Big Beast and the eventual winner, Rockfall, I think are going to be some really, really, really tough company for Work All Week if they stay healthy and they all end up facing each other, along with, hopefully, Masochistic and some of the good ones from the West Coast. This dirt sprint, older male dirt sprint division is becoming a very, very interesting division.
Yeah, and by the way, the Big Beast got bet like he wasn't going to lose.
Yeah.
Gee, I had to look twice at the tote board to make sure I wasn't, matching the odds with the wrong horses. But he got bet very, and he ran.
He ran great.
I mean, he got run down, in the last two jumps.
I don't know what the final margin was, but it was either a nose or a head.
The only word of caution I'll give, and I guess if I'm sitting in Matt Bernier's seat, then I'm performing the role, you know, that Pete was alluding to earlier. But, and this is no knock on any horse or any sprinter. The issue every single year is the horses you see in August in the sprint division aren't always the ones you see in early November. I mean, we work all week wasn't on our radar screens at this time last year. Even though he had a nice record, he was running in $50,000,
$75,000
listed stakes races. So it's exciting. Rock Falls run off two nice races in a row. Looks like work all week's getting back to last year's form. Maybe this very sporadic campaign will serve him well. The sprinters just don't dance at all the dances, and I'd love to see all these horses stick around in the Breeders' Cup sprint. I'd say more likely they won't. And one of the, you know, probably a couple of the horses that hit the board will be horses that we're not talking about even in September.
Well, and you make a fair point, because it'll be interesting to see who comes out of, say, a race like the King's Bishop, you know, an improving three-year-old. It could be one of the ones that we're already thinking, the Competitive Edges or even the Mr. Z's. A big race there would probably lead the trainer to target a race like the Breeders' Cup Sprint. But we'll see. It could be one of those horses who runs a really strong race at early in the Keeneland and just bursts on the scene like we had work all week last year. He ran a huge one. It was in the Phoenix, right? If I remember correctly. I want to think it was one graded stakes race sprint at Keeneland. Pete, I don't know if you remember, but it was one of those where it was, you know, an improving horse running against cheaper, supposedly, mm-hmm. and ran a big one and became a big player on the sprint scene. So it'll be interesting. Pete, your takeaway from the Vanderbilt?
I was impressed with how both those horses run, and while I understand Eric's caveat, I wouldn't be surprised to see either of those horses continue to be players on the scene. I guess I'm a little worried with the Big Beast. They've tried to get him back to races a bunch of times and had some issues. I did not actually get to read the recap. Did they seem happy with how he came out of the race? Is everything looking on the up and up with the Big Beast?
I haven't heard anything. Yeah, I haven't heard any follow-up at all. I didn't read the recap either, but I got to figure everybody
Bad
was happy.
Us.
Yeah, well, you know, I hear the news. I do know, you know, if a horse is off the, you know, injured or sidelined or going, you know, but I got to assume all was good with everyone. So, all right, well, we had a few other races. We'll just touch on them real quick. We mentioned Beholder. She couldn't have looked any better. I mean, I think we knew she was a very likely winner. She was bet like it, and at no time throughout the race did she ever look like she was in jeopardy of losing. I think the final margin was 7. Had American Pharoah not been running last weekend, she's probably the one we talk about, because I think they're thinking facing the boys next out. She has very little to prove, certainly in Southern California, against the older fillies and mares there, unless you're going to ship. That is the next step, and I would love to see what she does in a race like the Pacific Classic.
Yeah, me too. No, I mean, I don't need to see her run against the Southern California
Warren's
fillies
Vinetas
and mares. Yeah, Warren's Veneta. Look, I wish I owned Warren's Veneta. She's had a real nice campaign. And she's really emerged from near obscurity in February to pick up a lot of checks and a lot of black type. But, for me, Beholder, she either needs to take on the boys or not needs to, but I'd like to see her take on the boys or ship elsewhere.
Right. And, you know, really, especially the result of the Shuvie, where Untappable, Stop Charging Maria, they battled late, stopped charging Maria, pulled away right near the wire. They both ran very good races, but neither one really elevated themselves. I think Beholder in the older filly and mare division has really put herself on the top, on the pedestal. She's the one that needs to be knocked off, and especially if she now faces males in the next start. Assuming all goes well and she goes into the Breeders' Cup, she's going to be a really, I think, legitimate favorite in the, assuming she goes in the Breeders' Cup Distaff. Pete, your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm very excited to see her run in the Pacific Classic. It sounds like that is the plan from everything I'm seeing. And, I mean, to me, I love it for a trainer like a Mandela to make a move like that. And the way he's talked about her and the way Stevens has talked about her the whole time, it's pretty clear she's special and is up to this challenge. And hopefully it's another hurdle she can overcome. How crazy would that be if you end up with her and the Pharaoh both in the Classic? Again, I think timing-wise, it's probably not going to happen, but boy, some race that would be. I'm just very excited. I've always been a big Beholder fan ever since she was a two-year-old, and it's just great to see her out there winning races and just looking like a superstar.
Yeah, no, I'm with you, and it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, if she runs in that race, you got to assume she's going to face the opportunities and the catch of flights and maybe the hard aces, you know, and maybe a shipper or two, but against that field, I wouldn't be surprised if she were
I think she'll be favorite.
Pretty strong favorite. So,
what, Mike, did we get a buyer on the Shoe V?
We did. Of course, I didn't do the work. I didn't look. So,
no, I was just curious. I don't think the race came up super fast, and I have to. I mean, Untappable, I'm starting to wonder what happened between last year and this year. Not that she's been bad, but she's not the 102, 103
right.
kind of horse that
yep.
we saw last year, it would seem.
Right. Pete, you were going to say something?
Oh, I was just saying I didn't think she was the same. And I'm looking up that Shuve buyer right now.
Yeah.
Actually, I'll give it to you right this second.
Okay.
95 for Stop Charging, 93 for Untappable. So, yeah, right. I mean, just on the buyer speed figure scale, counting back, you know, you can see these aren't bad numbers, but I'll just run through a few of them. You know, with the last one being 93, the previous 93, two back 98, three back 95, and then 103, 94, 96, 96, 107,
100. Yeah.
Yeah, and all I got to say is if she runs a 95 in the Breeders' Cup Distaff, she's not hitting the board.
Right. Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah, and it seems clear she's not quite as good as she once was.
Yeah. And, you know, and I it's true. Yeah, she's probably going to be over bet just on name alone, but if there is a case where, you know, let's say you can argue that the prior race, what was it, in the Mother Goose, the Ogden Phipps, you know, maybe one turn is not really her best distance. Maybe getting back to two turns, she might have tired a little bit late. Perhaps you can foresee a move forward off of this race. I don't know. I'm generally with you guys that she's maybe lost a step since her three-year-old year. But if she ends up going in completely overlooked, and you know you've got your stellar wins, and you've got your you know, maybe Lovely Maria and Stop Charging Maria and Beholder, and she ends up fourth, fifth, sixth choice.
Carolina,
you know, she could end up being the value play.
If that's the case, if a defending champion can go in as sixth choice, you're right.
Stranger things
really
have happened.
See it.
Yeah,
you never know. If she's ever valued again, but you never know.
You're probably right. You're probably right. All right, we had a couple other public handicapper races we'll touch on real quick. We had the Bowling Green Red Rifle won. He got a win on the dirt on the turf. He's now had wins on all three surfaces. I don't have a whole lot to say about the race. It kind of shaped up relatively the way I thought it would, with Iron Power getting lead. He just wasn't good enough late. You know, good on Red Rifle.
Yeah, and Imagining was, I believe, the slight post-time favorite. Had a very wide trip under John Velasquez. For Pletcher, Red Rifle was one of three graded winners on the day. He won the Bowling Green was a grade two. Made from Lucky at the West Virginia Derby, which I think is one of your other public handicapper races. Also a grade two win, and of course the grade one Vanderbilt with Rockfall. So, you know, no need to pass the hat for Pletcher yet again.
Pete, any thoughts on the Bowling Green before we move on to the West Virginia Derby?
Red Rifle's just a tough, cool horse, and it's certainly nothing to knock him at all. But, you know, I don't think that was the strongest group of older turf males. I'm not sure that you'd consider him a major divisional player, but at the same time, that's a horse who's done a lot of different things and has just shown tough throughout his career, and I think is very cool. Even if he doesn't have any other major achievements in that division, I just think he's a fun horse to watch, and it was kind of fun to see him do well.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And you were there in person, so the West Virginia Derby, won by Made from Lucky, who I believe was the post time favorite, right? And the horse.
The post time favorite was Jerry Hollendorfer's horse.
Okay, I wasn't sure. I knew they were both 5-2.
I believe it was Hollendorfer.
Right.
If they were both 5-2, I could be wrong.
Yeah.
A minute to post, but.
Right. I'm not exactly sure, but yeah, Pete, you and I were both on Iron Fist, the Jerry Hollendorfer horse. Obviously, the 10-1 morning line we knew we weren't getting. I was shocked that I landed on the favorite, though.
I was too, and I was commenting to colleagues. I mean, at 5-2, I commented to Tom Lamara or somebody, I just don't get this horse at this price.
Right.
But I figured I must be missing something other than, you know, Hollendorfer and Mike Smith and fans latching on to that. Coming out of the West Virginia Derby, folks who just watched that one race from Mountaineer and didn't play the rest of the card should know that the outside of the track was where you wanted to be that day at Mountaineer. The only horse who sort of ran counter to that in any way was Work All Week, who was just tons
much
better.
The best, right.
But Bravo said after the race that, you know, we were fortunate to draw the post position we did. I tried to take advantage of it, and I had plenty of horse.
Right.
You know, Pletcher had him ready. But, you know, outside was the better part of the track. There was one trip horse of sorts in the race, and this is one of those races where you never know, did the trouble help him ultimately? But War Story sort of got sawed off at the beginning by Tale of Verve and really had to drop way back, and he was coming hard at the end. I mean, wow, this War Story really closed impressively. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see War Story wind up either in the Travers or the Pennsylvania Derby looking to make a late run for a lot of money.
Interesting. Yeah, and you mentioned outside was the place to be. Super Colossal was in the 11 post, and he ran great. He ran a big race, too. And I think Iron Fist looked like on the rail he was starting to make what could be called a winning move, but if the rail certainly was not where you wanted to be, that kind of move might not have been really the type of thing that you want to do. And I wonder if it's a case where you have an out-of-town jock in Mike Smith, maybe doesn't understand the way that track plays sometimes, and especially when you have, and I forget the race it was, but it was the dirt race prior to that one where you have Deshaun Parker
winning 70-1
on the outside. A local jock who knows how the track is playing is able to take advantage of things a little bit better than you know, a Southern California jock in to ride one or two mounts.
That, of course, was the West Virginia Delegates Commissioners Chairman's Cup. But by the way, Smith has been, I've been to quite a few, not as many as some, but I've been to quite a few West Virginia Derby. I feel like Mike Smith never misses the race. I think he's been to as many of those as he has Kentucky Derbies.
Okay.
He just always seems to be there for Chester, West Virginia's big day.
That's great. Pete, any comments from you on the West Virginia Derby, on Made from Lucky, on Iron Fist, on the wagering, on any of it at all? And we lost Pete. All right. You're back.
No,
Pete,
no,
what
no,
do you think?
Well, I have a comment on the race, but I just want to explain the technical difficulties that I assume are my fault to people who are watching this and not just listening to the pod. I was trying
Mike
to find
Mike and I are certainly assuming that as well. Keep going.
Well, You never know. But I was trying to find a place. The last few podcast webinars have been interrupted by barking dogs and various family members coming through the little house on the East Side Rec up here at Saratoga. So I was trying to find an alternative location today to deal with peace and quiet. But I think we're better off eschewing the peace and quiet and dealing with the stronger Wi-Fi connection going forward. So apologies for that. But I think that that's really great information to have about the outside on that day. I'll go back and watch the tape and corroborate that. That's exactly the kind of thing I like to put as a note in Formulator. And I think the point about War Story is a good one. When I interviewed Luch Racing manager Blake Jesse a few weeks ago after he won the Arlington Park handicapping contest, he mentioned to me one of the things he likes about working for Ron Paolucci is he's the kind of guy who likes to take shots. And I was actually a little surprised based on hearing that he liked to take shots that they didn't try the Haskell. But maybe they'll take their shot in the Travers. I think that's an interesting call there.
And I was a little confused by their choice of race also because they went back and forth. At one point, he was on Twitter saying, "We're going to the Haskell." And then a day later, they were back in West Virginia. So I wasn't quite sure. But I think also, I don't know if others were in this boat, but I think had they known the purse of the Haskell was going to be $1.75 million prior to that, Thursday. When did they announce that? Thursday?
Wednesday. I think it was the day before.
It was the day that American Pharoah arrived in Atlantic City and van to the track. If they had known that earlier, they may have run in that. Mm-hmm. But Monmouth may have been waiting to make sure that American Pharoah made it there safely and successfully before committing to the big purse. It was kind of an interesting wrinkle in that whole week-long set of activities.
And it was notable to me that War Story showed up in the barn of a different trainer now, moved from Tom Amos to Radosevich?
Because of the suspension.
Well, at first that's what I thought, but I noticed that Amos had other mounts, other horses.
Yeah, he ran a horse in the last race.
Mountaineer. Yeah, so that was when we talked on the podcast. I just assumed it was based to on the 45-day suspension that Amos had accepted. He was battling for a while, and he finally said, "Okay, I'll just take it." So I wonder if there's something more to that, if it's more of a long-term barn switch. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe it's the sort of thing, Pete, you could reach out to the barn manager and get a little bit more detail on.
Luch has used a whole bunch of trainers over the years.
They certainly have. Just look at Ria Antonia.
Yep.
All right. Well, that covers a lot of the big races from the weekend. I think we touched on all of them. We didn't mention, and I'd be remiss to not mention, Rachel Alexandra is now officially a producer. Her younger foal, the older one, Jess's Dream, is not run yet, but Rachel's Valentina was a debut maiden winner at Saratoga on Sunday as well. I got to imagine the future is bright for that one and probably will show up in a two-year-old stakes race next out. But aside from that, anything else we want to talk about before we move on to a few other topics?
I'm just guessing that Rachel's Valentina is currently 3-1 in Johnny Avello's Kentucky Oaks future book at the win.
Probably. And probably, I'm going to guess, 15-1 in the Derby. Yeah.
No, that's...
It was impressive. I thought it was a really great race.
It was. Absolutely. Absolutely.
A real feel-good result.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can tell Colmus was excited about
not
it.
Not for my bankroll.
I had tweeted out prior. I figured... Pletcher, Johnny V, Rachel Alexandra, two-year-old, I was figuring 1-2. So even money seemed like, I didn't bet the horse, but boy, I was surprised. I thought, boy, maybe she's even cold in the wagering. But all right, Pete, we'll do some quick tourney talk here, and then we'll move on to a couple other items and then call it a show.
Oh, we lost Pete there for a second. So what's now we got him
I'm
back.
Right back.
Go ahead, Pete.
I'm right back. I go out for 5 seconds and I come back. Sorry. Just wanted to mention really quickly about the win contest out in Vegas. It was an unbelievable story because earlier this year at the Horse Player World Series, a guy named McKay Smith thought he had locked up second place late in the tournament, only to get run down by Paul Sherman when he played this 60-1 shot at Fairgrounds. And Sherman ended up second and Smith third for about a $50,000 difference in payouts. Well, the shoe was on the other foot at the Wynn, where Bill Sherman, Paul's brother, was right on or near the lead going into the last race. And McKay Smith used his double bet and caught some place points to elevate himself over Bill Sherman for an $80,000 shift. I just thought it was amazing. Same.
It's like that Seinfeld episode. I'm even Steven.
Yeah. McKay's plus 30 grand.
plus 30
exactly.
grand.
Exactly. So that was a bit wild. That was the big story of the weekend. I have that written up, and folks can check that out on drf.com. Obviously, writing about tournaments 5 days a week, sometimes more, on the DRF website.
That's great. Well, I wanted to mention a couple other things recently. I know you guys are both DRF Bets members. I've been taking advantage of the DRF Bets promos that they've had recently. A lot of the promos tend to be focused on new signups, and certainly if you're not a member and you want to become one, there's some really good ones. But I love that this summer they've been focusing on folks like me who are already members. They want to try and get you to play either races or bets that you might not necessarily, even if you're playing your other ones. So the one I love is the Saturday. There was a Friday one where at certain tracks, it's usually Del Mar and Saratoga, they do a 25% bonus on any winning pick five wagers up to $250. So if you can hit it for a grand, you get $250 extra. That's pretty cool. The Saturday one is the one that I love because it's almost like a free bankroll builder. Have you been playing this at all, Eric?
Yeah, I made all my Exactabox, Mountaineer Exactabox plays on DRF Bets, and I believe I'm due a hefty refund for my bad handicapping.
Well, the thing I love about it is it doesn't quote-unquote penalize you if you hit. You get $25 back in any losing Exactaboxes. So you can do a $2 Exactabox and you hit, you keep going, you do a $2 Exactabox and you lose, you get $4 back. You do a $2 Exactabox and you lose again, you get $8 back. And you hit another one, it's free bankroll building, even if you're not necessarily, and I hadn't really handicapped Mountaineer or Monmouth, which is what they had last weekend, but I said, hey, I'll pull up some of our guys, I'll take a look at some of the races, I'll do some quick handicapping, because I have nothing to lose.
Right.
You know, if I hit the bet, great, I cash the bet, and I got extra bankroll. If I don't, I get it funded back in my account, or, you know, in a few days, and probably will be tomorrow, I would imagine, from Saturday's wager. So that's one that I love, just because even if you're not thinking about it, it's free money. Free money. And there aren't many opportunities for that sort of thing. So check it out. Sign up if you haven't. If you already are a member, just go to drf.com/exotic, REG, and you sign up and have at it. Also want to mention I've got a pretty exciting webinar tomorrow. Usually Pete and I will do the Thursday ones, focusing on different aspects of Formulator. We had one scheduled for this week, which we moved to next Thursday, diving deep on trainer patterns. We've done that before, but I think it's the kind of thing that we certainly can do over and over again. So we'll move that to next week, because tomorrow I'm doing one with Mike Welsh, where we're going to go over the Wednesday card. It's a carryover, so that'll be of particular interest. Anybody that's signing up for it will get a free file of Wednesday's clocker report for Saratoga. It's even if you're not interested, you're not sure what it's all about, you can ask questions to Mike about how do you read it, how do you play it, how do you use it in conjunction with the other aspects of your handicapping. Of course, it's something that comes out only the day before, and a lot of times if you're looking ahead to the weekend, you might be handicapping 2 or 3 days out, come up with your opinions. So it's nice. You get to figure out how to use the clocker report to augment some of the other more traditional handicapping tools in your arsenal. I'm excited about it. So,
I'm excited for you, Mike.
Well, thanks, Eric. I appreciate that.
It sounds good. You get a heavy hitter on the webinar to join you instead of just, you know, having me go back and forth. We got Mike Welsh, who's been doing this for a couple of years and he really knows his stuff. I love those workout reports. I think those guys do a really good job. I sit next to them both up in the press box here in Saratoga and always interested, I have to say. And boy, especially with this, what better day to do it than having that that big pick six carryover to go through. You've got a winner on your hands here, Mike.
Yeah, you know, it'll be fun. And I like to look at the handicap or the Clocker report less about the strict grade A, B, C, whatever, but reading between the lines of the details. There was a Chad Brown horse yesterday, I tweeted it out, that they said was trying to take a bite out of its work partner in one of the works. And the horse ended up, was coming off a maiden win, ended up running last. And so, you know, I don't know if it was connected to that, but, you know, sometimes you see little things that might make you either pause or might make you say, huh, that's interesting. You know, Judy the Beauty was working with two maidens, you know, maybe made me think that she wasn't ready to fire her biggest effort, and she, you know, just those little things. I mean, granted, you don't want to put a whole lot of added weight. You know, you got to do the other work. You do the formulator patterns. You watch the race replays. But it's those little bits of information that sometimes can push you one way or another when you're trying to make your decision. So
I know we've spoken about when we see it in the Clocker report that so-and-so worked out with Irad Ortiz Jr. up, and then the race day comes and Irad Ortiz Jr. is riding a different horse. And sometimes that, again, you can outthink yourself, of course, but it gives you a fuller, broader picture of the race and the preparations that led up to it, which at Saratoga is extra valuable.
Absolutely. There were a couple last summer. Yeah. A couple last summer especially that I remember where Joel Rosario was aboard a horse in the morning, listed on the Clocker report as being on the work, ended up showing up on a different debuting maiden. And in both cases, Joel's horse that he chose ended up winning the race, and at decent prices, too. So,
Or that Ron Anderson chose.
Exactly. So that'll be a fun one. Check it out on Twitter. You can go to drf.com. There's a marquee if you want to sign up. It's Wednesday, if you're listening to this or watching it, it's Wednesday at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Of course, if you miss it, we'll have archived versions to watch later. Should be a fun one.
All right.
All right, Pete, Eric, thank you guys for joining. Any final words before we hand it over to Mr. Fornatel for the sign-off?
Just, hey, it's Whitney Week coming up, and that race is coming up just terrific.
Yeah.
And so we've got for harness players, the Hambletonian is at the Meadowlands, and we'll have full card PPs in the Saturday form for that. So you can get your trot on, so to speak, on Saturday. Just a lot going on at DRF and DRF.com right now.
That's great. Pete?
The town.
Right.
Oh, well, we'll have to go with the Whitney and the Hambletonian, okay. I guess.
All right.
I was just sorry about that. I was just going to say the town's going to be invaded by contest players for next week. I think a lot of them are coming in early for the Whitney, and I feel like I should send us home before my screen goes black again. What do you guys think?
Do it.
Good deal.
May you win all your photos.